wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this May 25th Monday. I want to thank again the dedicated KBOO staff who have, for these last 2 months, been keeping the amazing radio produced for our community on the air. Thank you. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews economist Yeva Nersisyan, who has been recently studying and writing on the federal multi-trillion dollar relief programs as the pandemic shut down the economy. Bill and Yeva will discuss these relief programs as well as what should and could be done short and long term. Yeva Nersisyan is a research scholar at the Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity and an associate professor of economics at Franklin and Marshall College. Book mole Larry Bolden reviews Tessa Hadley's 2019 novel, Late in the Day. Read by old mole Patricia Kohlberg, Larry explores this story of two close-knit couples whose lives are irrevocably changed by an untimely death. And we'll conclude this morning's program with Joe Clement talking with trained chef and journalist Arun Gupta about the American food system under conditions of the pandemic. They consider the plight of food workers up and down the supply chain and the political economy behind the disconnect between the hungry masses and the intentional destruction of food. I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks again for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like The Old Mole. And remember, you can find us on the web. Look for The Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour. And now, Bill Resnick and Yeva Nersisyan.
Hello, Yeva Nersisyan. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Glad to be here.
Yeva Nersisyan got her college degree from the Yerevan State University of Armenia, studied economics, applied to the U.S. State Department for a scholarship for advanced study in economics, was accepted and sent to the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and was she lucky? It was one of the four or so quite progressive graduate economic programs in this country. She did well, stayed to get a PhD. She's written a lot, began work at Franklin and Marshall. She's recently been studying and writing on the federal multi-trillion dollar relief programs as the pandemic shut down the economy. She and many others have found that the federal government is continuing a 50-year trend that big business, the banks, fossil fuel industry, the private sector, their executives, those folks have done fairly well in the pandemic and getting federal money. As to small business and the great majority of people, help has been erratic and small. There is some help, to be sure, but precarious and fear have increased. We'll be discussing all that and also, of course, what should and could be done short and long term. So, Yeva Nersisyan, first give us a brief overview of what's coming out of the national government, their pandemic relief, and who are the major beneficiaries.
So the first steps were taken by the Fed as a part of monetary policy, sort of had lowered interest rates and opened a host of facilities for lending to banks and other financial institutions, also foreign central banks. And these resembled or were very much like the facilities that they had created during the financial crisis. So they sort of had a blueprint and were ready to go. And they added some other programs later, although it's not clear whether they're already operational or not. But then on the fiscal side, Congress took action, which was good. The action was swift, and the stimulus was much bigger than what we did during the financial crisis. So, for instance, the CARES Act that has already passed and implemented to some extent was about $2.2 trillion. By comparison, the Obama stimulus was about $800 billion. So in a way, I guess it was good that we had a Republican president and, you know, Democrats who in Congress who would not say no to stimulus spending, while if the positions were reversed, it's not clear whether we would get this kind of fiscal action so quickly. But the CARES Act includes the now famous $1,200 stimulus checks, $1,200 per person, or twice that for families, and it gets phased out after a certain income level, and $500 per child. It also boosted unemployment benefits. It prolonged how long workers could stay on it and added an extra $600 to weekly unemployment checks. This was a welcome thing because the unemployment benefits in the United States are, of course, notoriously stingy. We replace about 43% of workers' wages on average. In some states, that can be much lower, while in others can be higher. But 43%, that's not very high at all, especially if you think about low-wage workers, right, who are hardly making ends meet with all of their wages. Now, having to survive on only 43% of that, or even less in some states, that would not be possible. So they also added the extra $600 per week, which was good for workers. But of course, there was also giveaways to big businesses. So some $500 billion or so was set aside for the Treasury to distribute to airlines, businesses like that with little strings attached. And that's not all of what's going to go to big companies, of course, because the Fed is also adding its own support by, say, buying corporate bonds, by, you know, lending for purchases of short-term bonds and so on. They also had some money set aside. I believe it was initially $350 billion or $349 for small businesses. Those are businesses that have less than 500 workers. So as you can see, there could be very wide range among the small businesses. Some of them can be really small and others can be rather large. And the small businesses could then apply for loans through financial institutions, banks in particular. And if they spent about 75% of the loan on payroll, and if they kept their employees on payroll for at least 8 weeks, then the loan would be forgiven. So this would then basically become like grants. They could also use some of that money to pay rent, utilities, other expenses. So the other 25% could be used for that. The rollout of the program was problematic, although the second round, when they added more funding, seems to have gone somewhat better. Because this is all going through banks, right? So the companies that had relationships with banks had a much easier time accessing the funds. And a lot of the large banks basically said that if you're not their customer, they would not be processing your application for the loan. And the smaller institutions, community-based institutions that are not necessarily banks, I think were shut out of the program, so they couldn't become lenders, even though they could be more efficient, like efficient in, you know, knowing the small businesses in their community and getting the money to them. And of course, we had all the scandals with large companies getting funding, because I think the law allowed for that to happen, because if you were a franchise of a large company and you had fewer than 500 employees, then you would qualify. And I think this is how these large companies were able to get funding through the CARES Act, even though the intent was to direct this funding to small businesses. In a way, it's not clear why we did it this way, because we have this middleman in the process, like the banks, that is making the process difficult. You know, we are first granting loans and then forgiving the loans. And then the banks are, of course, pocketing fees in the process and so on. Instead, we could have gone the way of Denmark, for instance, where the government basically said, we'll just make payroll ourselves. Right. So instead of giving money to the banks so that banks could then lend to the businesses, so that's a process that could become glitchy, right? It's difficult to ensure that money's getting to these small businesses. I read that minority-owned businesses especially were not able to get the loans because they don't have relationships with banks, right? In general, it is difficult for minority-owned businesses to get loans from banks, so they didn't have these relationships which would have helped them to get the funding, and so they sort of got left out to a great extent. So instead of all of this, we could just have the government make payroll for the smaller businesses, right? So keep workers attached to the businesses, and at the same time, making sure that the workers are getting their wages. That would have been a much better way to go.
This is KB Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, your old mobile variety hour. I'm talking to Yelena Narcissian, a progressive economist who's been studying the government economic response to the COVID epidemic. As to business, the big ones, she's discussed they've done pretty well at the federal trough. As to the people, well, they're American tough. They can get by mostly on their own. Surely those with paid-for homes and millions in the bank. Yeah, but let's talk more about the problems of the poor and small business and what should be done. You got into that in the previous interview, but let's get down to the ground level, like the precariousness and anxiety, rent, mortgages, food, medical care. What about essential workers? What, in fact, is in the schools? Are any of the federal agencies, to what extent are states getting money for public schools? Or aren't they, in fact, now going to have to vastly, vastly cut their budgets in order to keep up some kind of skeleton school or skeleton public hospitals? The private sector is getting a lot of money, especially the big ones. What about the public and the public schools and public hospitals and all of the rest? And, of course, little people who you get your $1,200 that may pay the rent in some places for 1 month. What's the future look like?
Yes, the $1,200 was not going to help very much. My colleague Randy Ray and I looked at some numbers trying to find out how much does the average American family spend on different things. So the data was as of 2016, so about $600 went for food. Mortgage, rent were around $1,300, a little over that, a little under $400 on health care, a little over $400 on car loans, about $350 on student loans, and about another $454 different kinds of loans like credit cards and so on. So, I mean, you can already see, right, the $1,200 was never going to be enough for the average person, even for a month, although our Treasury Secretary seems to think that it could last people for a few months. So that's why the additional unemployment benefits was so important. The problem is that our unemployment system is not set up to accommodate so many people so quickly. So people have a difficulty applying for unemployment benefits. I think as of recently, we've had 36 million people unemployed. So imagine that many people applying through, you know, outdated state systems. And there were reports in the media about how the technologies that the unemployment offices were relying on were from, I don't know, 1980s or even earlier. So there were a lot of glitches in processing these applications and getting money to the people. So in a way, what we see is that we have the infrastructure to provide funds to corporations very quickly. We don't necessarily have that for the average person and the smaller businesses. So for instance, the Fed committed to buying corporate bonds and also short-term bonds, or not buying directly, but at least lending to institutions for buying them is basically the same thing. And this provided a lifeline for large corporations very quickly.
They were buying junk bonds. They were taking these very speculative instruments and, in fact, ensuring that the rich people who bought those on speculation, no poor people are buying junk bonds, they're ensuring that they get their money.
Yeah.
It's a welfare program for not just for the rich, but for the rich speculators. Like the oil industry, these companies, the fracking companies that should be out of business because they're not competitive with the price of oil as it is with the glut of oil, they're just getting bailed out.
Yes, and it's not just fossil fuel companies. If you look at corporate debt levels were at their highest level before this all started. So even without this, if there was a recession, which was going to happen sooner rather than later, some companies would go, you know, out of business, and of course, including probably a lot of oil companies. But now they are sort of being bailed out to some extent, or at least their life is being prolonged because now they, you know, the Fed will buy their bonds, you know, in this primary market. You know, it will buy them from companies directly. It will buy them from investors, like you said. But in a way, that is the function of the Fed, right? The function of the Fed is to stabilize the price of assets. And to the extent that the assets, such as stocks and bonds, right, the Fed doesn't directly buy stocks, but it can still stabilize markets and therefore stabilize asset prices in general. But most of these are owned by higher income individuals. And so most of that support is going to benefit those who own assets. It's the federal government through Congress, right, through fiscal policy action that we talked about, that's what can help stabilize wages and prevent wages from falling and prevent prices from falling. So by either directly hiring workers or by stimulating the economy so that companies continue to hire workers and so on. So stimulating the real economy, so to speak, fiscal policy is much better suited for that. The Fed can stabilize the financial system. It doesn't necessarily have a lot of tools for stabilizing the real economy, so to speak. That's where Congress has to do more, and in this case, they did more than they did in 2008. But given the size of the problem, it may not be enough. You know, whatever they've done so far may not be enough.
What about the public schools and all of those state institutions and public hospitals and all public programs, especially in the states that actually take the public sphere seriously and try and protect their water and have decent schools? That's not Mississippi and Alabama, but it is New York and California. They're getting killed, I think. They're killing the public sector. That's my fear. What do you, what's your sense?
So the states did not get very much in the initial bill. I think it was about $150 billion out of a $2.2 trillion bill. That's not very much at all. In the new bill that passed the House, but that's unlikely to pass the Senate in its current form, there is $1 trillion allocated to states. Of course, the states are going to be hit super hard because of their falling revenues, because they depend on sales tax for a lot of their revenues, and there's not a lot of sales happening. So they're going to be hit really hard. And what we saw in 2008, and that's the mistake we should not repeat, is that the states had to slash their spending on the kind of public services that you're talking about, which, of course, that's bad because you're cutting the services, but it's also bad for macroeconomic purposes, because in a time when spending is falling, the federal government is trying to stimulate more spending. The state and local governments, because of the way their budgets are set up, are actually acting against the federal government, right? They are withdrawing spending because they can't run deficits in many cases. So if their revenues are falling, they have to slash their spending, and that is a drag on the recovery. So hopefully Congress will act and they will allocate more to the states. But of course, we've seen, you know, some of the feuds about bailing out the blue states, right? I mean, Mitch McConnell has mentioned that we're not going to bail out the blue states and so on. So who knows what will happen, but you're absolutely right. We do need to provide funding for state and local governments, and the $150 billion was nothing near what was needed. Now, here to the Fed's credit, something they did this time, which they did not do in 2008, you know, after the 2008 crisis, they established this municipal lending facility where they are basically going to do what they're doing for corporations, for state and local governments. So they will be buying the bonds of state and local governments, basically lending to them. That's good, but it's not as good as what could be done through congressional action, because if they borrow, they still have to pay this back at some point, right? So it's keeping them alive today, but at some point this debt has to be paid back. While if the federal government grants them money, this is not debt. And this is the difference between monetary and fiscal policy. Monetary policy basically acts by allowing people to take on more debt, right? Allowing banks and companies to borrow more, right? Because the Fed can only lend. The Fed cannot spend money into the economy. Well, fiscal policy acts through spending into the economy. So it's not adding to the debt of people and companies. It's actually increasing incomes.
This is Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, your old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Yevhen Nersissian, progressive economist studying the government economic response to the COVID epidemic. We've been discussing how the big boys have done pretty well under the multi-trillion dollar CARES Act. the states and most working people have not done so well. The House passed a program that would deal with those inequities. It's not clear it'll succeed nationally in the absence of an enormous movement. I hope that that can be built. Let's conclude very briefly. Today's pandemic reveals the pathologies of our current system, so many of them: housing, medical care, employment, dire poverty, housing as a commodity, keep people precarious, life expectancies falling, suicides rising, lots of children growing up hungry. And, of course, we have not been preparing for the pandemics or for doing very much at all, even under Clinton, Bush, and Obama, much less the despicable Trump, about climate change. You've been writing about what could be done. We really can't talk about that now, but it's very important at least to mention it. Tell us what you see as a solution to, in fact, these immense difficulties that humanity, that people here and all humanity are going through and will become much worse unless something is done.
Yeah, so the approach to tackling climate change has been minimal, if non-existent, basically. And a lot of the issues you mentioned are related, right? So people don't have health care, people don't have jobs, or at least guaranteed jobs. And so they are at the mercy of the economic cycle, and millions become unemployed during recessions, but also millions are unemployed even in good times. And our longest recovery that we had prior to the pandemic was masking a lot of these issues. And so the pandemic has brought all of them to the surface. And I think it should be added that all of those issues are present in the richest country in the history of the world, right? So the solution, I would say, is some kind of a Green New Deal. And when I say Green New Deal, I mean it as comprehensive as possible. So the Green New Deal proposed by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for instance, which includes tackling climate change, but also Medicare for all, a job guarantee, ending the forever wars, and so on. And what the pandemic has shown us is that, first of all, we do need healthcare for all, for instance, right? And that we do need some kind of federal jobs infrastructure that can be activated in times of recessions, but also in times like this, in a pandemic, when there is a need for workers for particular jobs, but we don't have a government infrastructure for putting people to work. And so we need to create all of those. And what the crisis has shown, what this pandemic has shown, is that when it comes to the federal government, money is not an issue. So before this, people were estimating the cost of the Green New Deal, and there was an estimate that it was going to cost us $93 trillion, and most of that was for Medicare for All and the job guarantee. And of course, then we hear that we're going to bankrupt our grandchildren and so on. What the pandemic shows is that money is not an issue for the federal government. They passed the $2.2 trillion act and nobody blinked, right? I mean, just 2 months ago, if we said we need a stimulus of $2 trillion or that's going to go through Congress, people would think you're crazy. But now there is another bill for $3 trillion and the Fed has basically said that its support is going to be unlimited, right? So suddenly we have the money for all of these things. But, just 2 months ago, we didn't have money for anything. At the same time, if you don't have the real stuff, like if you don't have enough masks and PPE and ventilators, money is not necessarily going to help, right? If you're producing as much as you possibly can, then adding more money is simply going to, lead to higher prices. It's not going to lead to more output. So my colleague Randy Ray and I, we wrote a policy brief last year where we basically demonstrated that we have to think about the Green New Deal in terms of real resources. Do we have the technology? Do we have resources such as workers and other resources to implement the Green New Deal? And if the answer is yes, then money and finance cannot be an impediment because the federal government is not financially constrained. And I'm saying this as a modern money theory economist, and modern money theory has become quite popular following the pandemic. So the Green New Deal is the way to go because it tackles climate change and it does so in a short timeline. So 10 years or 20 years, something like that. I think our estimates were based on 10 years. We don't have 2050, right? A lot of programs and projections are we're going to cut emissions and we're going to cut our reliance on fossil fuels by 2050. No, we don't have until 2050 and even 10 years, right? Even that is not fast enough because we've let this go for so long. At the same time, we need something like a Medicare for all. All of our peer countries have it. If you've ever been to Europe and you've used their medical system, you know that it works perfectly fine. It's super affordable. I go to France every summer, and if I need medical care there, I don't even ask my insurance for reimbursement when I come back because the amount that I spend there is probably less than or comparable to what my payment would be here in the United States after my insurance pays. Okay? So they have public medical care and it works perfectly fine, public health insurance, basically. And we, of course, need a job guarantee because a job guarantee program would guarantee everyone who wants a job a decent wage job, at least $15 an hour. It would raise the minimum wage and it would ensure that joblessness is not an issue, that we don't have people who are involuntarily unemployed because even at the peak of the recovery, we had at least 10 million people who were unemployed and underemployed. And that's the way to tackle poverty and inequality. You're tackling it from the source rather than sort of trying to use some kind of redistributive system after income has already been distributed unequally. So a job guarantee would be a better approach to doing it. Yeah, that's the way we need to.
Doing all of that in ways that would stop climate roasting. It seems to me that we really do have the program and we have the money. The question is whether we have the social movements and the strength politically to prevail in the struggle. Yeva Narcissian, thanks so much for talking to us today. Keep up the good work.
Thank you for having me over virtually.
So long.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Next on The Old Mole, Patricia Kohlberg reads Book Mole Larry Bolden's review of Tessa Hadley's 2019 novel, Late in the Day.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg reading today for Book Mole Larry Bolden. It is always such a pleasure to stumble onto a writer previously unknown who absolutely commands attention. Tess Hadley is such a writer. Today, I want to talk about her 2019 novel, Late in the Day. I am so struck with her writing and her wisdom that I find trying to review her work daunting, and I'm not at all sure I'm up to the task. Like the great author Elizabeth Bowen, whom Hadley deeply admires, Hadley writes primarily, even exclusively, about domestic scenes. While her characters may be more brilliant and creative than most people, what she tries to describe carefully, minutely, are the everyday concerns of people living intimately together. Christine and Lydia have been devoted friends since their early 20s, and their two husbands, Alexander and Zachary, are nearly as close. Zach and Lydia own a small but well-known art gallery. Christine is an artist, and her husband, Alex, is a teacher and art dealer. The foursome are as close as any four friends could be and are drawn even closer in that each has a daughter of roughly the same age who grow up together in the bosom of that extended family. Suddenly and unexpectedly, when all four are in their 50s, Zach dies of a heart attack. And in the aftermath of his death, Lydia moves in with Alex and Christine and the two daughters, Grace and Isabel, stay in Isabel's flat. All agree that Zach is the most irreplaceable, the glue binding them together. At first, it seems that the loss of Zach will bring the other three closer together, and in many senses it does. But eventually, due to entanglements from their pasts, as well as the different ways they cope with the loss, the relationships begin to fray. The story is far too complex to simply gloss, and it is not really the story or its outcome that matter most to Hadley. It is the almost minute-by-minute transformations that she expertly reveals. I first started reading this book in 2019, but gave up on it after about 50 pages. It just seemed too complex, and I'm sure I moved on to something lighter and less demanding. This is not a novel that can or should be read in small snippets of weeks or months. Like another book of hers, The Past, it is best read in a sustained manner, not quickly, but with rather complete attention. In broad terms, suffice it to say that when Christine and Lydia first met Alex, who was himself already married, it was Lydia who became obsessed with him, who felt she must find a way into his life. Quote, "But Christine felt how Alex didn't respond to this charm of Lydia's, as he was supposed to. Lydia's audacious frankness, her wide-eyed delivery, complacent like a purring cat, which had been so confounding to other men, didn't impress him. In Alex's presence, so perfected and adult, Lydia's cleverness seemed flawed and homemade, embarrassing like a precocious child's." End quote. And so it is Christine who ends up marrying Alex, though as the story unwinds, it becomes obvious that the flame in Lydia for Alex lies smoldering through the years to come. There is much discussion among the friends in their little community of intellectuals and artists about the nature of art, of what constitutes great art, and with the question of whether women can be serious artists. Quote, "Lydia put in her own remarks among the men, and they all deferred to her, but Christine saw that they didn't quite take what she said seriously. Not because they thought it was stupid exactly, but because her appearance blocked their attention like a dazzle of sunlight in a reflection off glass. They were exaggeratedly solicitous and encouraging when the girls spoke, as they were with one another. There was a danger, Christine thought, that you might end up performing for them like a curiosity, and Lydia was inclined to show off if she had an audience." End quote. Eventually, the situation devolves into a love triangle, or perhaps I should say a love quadrangle. Angers and resentments boil up over many things. Zach comes into a great deal of money, which allows him to buy the art gallery and to begin to buy and trade prestigious artworks. Rather than being envious of Zach and Lydia's wealth, it is Zach's attempts to help the other couple financially that begin to cause rifts in their relationship. Hadley is not one to tie things up neatly in the end. Like real life, things are left dangling and incomplete. Quote, "Alex had said once that she, Christine, ought to give up her hope of wholeness, of a meaning, because it was naive." Letting herself into the flat, Christine was glad to be alone. Solitude and silence had begun to be sensuous pleasures for her. It would have been awful in that moment to give false explanations to anyone, perform the sociability she did not feel. Instead, she slipped off her shoes before she walked around the rooms, as if she didn't want to intrude even her own presence noisily. End quote. Besides her four novels, Hadley has also published several volumes of short fiction. I intend to read all of her work. She is a rare find and a superb writer. I have been talking about Tess Hadley's novel, Late in the Day. This is Patricia Kullberg, reading for Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Home, home, oh yeah.
We conclude this morning's program with Joe Clement talking with trained chef and journalist Arun Gupta about the American food system under conditions of the pandemic. Joe?
Thanks, Denise. Well, you may have heard of how the food supply chain is almost broken, how because of the lockdown, different parts of how we produce, move, and procure our food is being threatened. My guest today, Arun Gupta, is a journalist who is covering COVID and its impact on farm workers, but he has a broader background in the food system as a trained chef and a food critic with a book coming out, Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction, a Junk Food Loving Chef's Inquiry into Taste. He's written for Washington Post, The Intercept, Jacobin, The Guardian, and his latest article about COVID and farm workers is going to be published through In These Times. Thanks, Arun, for coming on The Old Mole today to talk about this most essential of human systems.
Great to be here with you.
Well, I wanted to talk about the different parts of the food system and how they're being affected by the pandemic and how they all fit together anyway. And most food, in one way or another, starts from the ground. And it takes human labor, in a lot of cases, to coax that food out of the ground.
What has been going on in America's farms? What is the state of our agricultural system? And how is it being impacted by the pandemic right now?
It's dramatic. I think the best way to think about it is there's this very famous anthropologist in food studies, Sidney Mintz. He's often called the founder or father of food studies. He once said that nothing changes food and food systems more than war. And so we think of this like a war, and you have your own government essentially waging war on you, then we begin to understand the scale at which food systems are being disrupted. So everyone is experiencing this. You know, you can't really go to restaurants anymore, grocery stores, unless you come from another country. You never encountered shortages or rationing in your lifetime. You have to go back to World War II. We see this the whole system breaking down. So you have these shortages in the grocery store. Meanwhile, at the same time, there are estimates that as many as 10 million hogs might be euthanized by June because meat processing plants have become hotspots of a coronavirus due to the cramped working conditions, lack of worker rights and protections, the cold temperatures also. So there's been outbreaks at least 115 beef, pork, and poultry plants across the country, and so they don't have the processing country. And this also has a lot to do with kind of the monopoly control where you just have a few firms now controlling meat processing. And so you can't just tell animals to stop growing, and so they're having to kill off all these animals. But one thing that is getting left out is the farm workers, which, you know, we need to think about a lot more.
And that's because these folks are also working in very cramped situations, or they're living in them often near the farms. And they are the people who make sure that anything gets out of the ground and get to people.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in terms of obviously mechanization has been going on in the farms for a long time. But other than kind of like grain and oil crops, soy, corn, wheat, rice, there isn't a lot of mechanical harvesting, you know, and we think about it, maybe that tomato, that nice looking hothouse tomato, those strawberries that you eat, well, someone had to pluck those, but agricultural workers do so much more. They're also helping to raise those hogs. They're in the chicken houses. I've been talking to dairy farm workers in upstate New York. We're taking care of hundreds of calves. They're tending to vines, grapevines. They're grafting them and plucking the grapes. If you would enjoy a bottle of wine, apples, oranges, whatever you can think of, any sort of fruit or vegetable is almost always going to involve farm workers. And, you know, I do want to make a point, like you see a lot of people, and in fact, there's a New York Times editorial today, oh, people need to give up meat because of the effects on the workers. If you want to go by that logic, you should basically give up all food. This idea of instrumentalizing people's oppression to try and fix another oppression is a really mistaken approach, because there are 2.5 million farm workers across the country. A majority of them are undocumented. And you made a really important point. It's not the working conditions, it's the living conditions where they are being exposed to coronavirus. And there are these outbreaks going on across the country among the people who pick your fruit and vegetables. They're just not getting as much publicity at a meat processing plant. But in upstate New York, for instance, there's a hydroponic farm, 1.4 million square feet under glass, that grows all sorts of vegetables, including huge amounts of tomatoes and strawberries. Half its workforce, 169 workers, came down with coronavirus because the labor subcontractor was packing them four to a motel room, to a bed. In North Carolina, there are at least five different farms where there have been coronavirus outbreaks. In Oregon, Woodburn, Oregon, is the center of coronavirus infections in the state, and that's where there's lots of farm and farm workers as well. In central Washington state, there are outbreaks on various farms. So again, if you want to protect workers, you should stop eating all fruit. And in fact, in the last week, there have been at least seven different strikes in Yakima, Washington, among a workforce that's overwhelmingly Latino, striking against unsafe working conditions, demanding more hazard pay, and demanding proper PPE. So, you know, this is something that is much more hidden and getting much less reporting, because basically, as oppressed as meatpacking plant workers are, farm workers are far more oppressed. And it's estimated anywhere from 48% at the low end to over 70% are undocumented. You have this ethno-nationalist president persecuting them in every single way, while also saying they're decreeing their essential workers. And so the farm workers we talked to, so many have said that they're afraid to get tested because they can't afford to lose their job. They can't afford to lose their income. Often their housing is tied to their job, and they normally work sick anyway. So we're creating the conditions for coronavirus outbreak throughout many rural areas in America.
There are other kinds of processing that goes on too, not just meat processing. Most of the food that we get, unless it's like fresh vegetables, goes through some degree of processing and packaging. And are those workers being affected in the same way?
You know, the thing is, when we think of processing also, you know, remember, even the, like, strawberries are processed. They're cleaned and washed. It isn't just going straight from the field onto your dinner plate. There is always some bit of processing. Now, what we think of is, like, industrial processing, like canning or flash freezing for fresh food. That's more intensive processing. Then you have the processing where you're taking, say, that rice and turning it into like rice-a-roni or minute rice or something like that, that involves a whole complicated chemical manufacturing process. So we're also seeing outbreaks in things like seafood plants, commercial bakeries, vegetable processing plants, any enclosed space where people are in sustained contact with each other. And so that's why we're seeing it spread in factories. We're also seeing it in warehouses. So all these areas where the goods are gathered, these central distribution points, and, you know, we have to remember, since we have this just-in-time production system, it relies on these massive distribution centers. And in fact, there are these mega distribution centers. So Walmart has, they've got maybe 100 distribution centers across the country, but then they have three huge distribution centers, some of the biggest warehouses in the world. For instance, in Southern California, in the Inland Empire, their complex of warehouses, there's something, I think, on the scale of like 3 million square feet. It would take you close to 20 minutes to walk across some of these warehouses. They're so vast. And when you have so many workers in that space, and if there's an outbreak there, think of how long it would take to disinfect it, an insanely long time, or you just have to quarantine it for weeks. So we're seeing this disruption throughout the distribution chain, and then obviously it moves on from there into the grocery stores.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Portland-based journalist and trained chef Arun Gupta about the food supply and the impact of coronavirus on it.
Michael Pollan has a forthcoming article in the New York Review of Books about the sickness in our food supply, And he points to the concentration of distribution networks. We've heard that there is all kinds of stress on the supply chain and that it's breaking down in some way. But the main issue that I've heard as far as supply and food having to be thrown out comes down to institutional buyers dropping out of these markets, because our system is a market system. The farmers or commodity food producers don't have a way of connecting their product to the set of people who get it from farm to whatever its ultimate destination is. Could you speak to that situation and really how insurmountable it is or isn't?
Yeah, I saw one that basically only 30% of our calories come through grocery stores. I did look at some research recently that said 21% of our calories comes through restaurants. But then you have things like the school lunch and breakfast program, which provides billions of meals a year to children. So that's a major supplier. You have institutional settings. You have things like the military, again, prison, living facilities, residential care, nursing care. And so now, like trying to take this huge flow of water and shove it through a small space, and we're trying to push this massive amount of goods into grocery stores and through grocery stores. And you have simple things going on, like a lot of producers, a lot of agribusinesses, a lot of processors, they're not packaging flour in 5-pound bags. They're packaging them in 100-pound bags, if not even much bigger containers for industrial producers. So they don't have the means to just quickly ship to consumer sales. Then it's also a question of the market. Even if you could suddenly shift, well, who are you going to sell it through? Can't suddenly have everyone buying everything online, you know, from individual producers. That would be extremely inefficient. The reason we have supermarkets is because the idea you can go there and get all goods. You don't want to have to, like, order your eggs from the egg farm and everything individually. And then also a lot of stuff that we eat, and I've been noticing this, even though I'm a trained professional chef, trained in classical French cuisine, and I can cook all sorts of different cuisines, but I am not having the variety of food when they could go grab food at a restaurant or a bakery or 1,000 different places. So we find high demands for some food, like eggs, are flying off the shelf, and I find myself eating a lot more eggs. Why? Because it's something simple, it's nutritious, you get fat, protein, it's very versatile. But then there's, say, like all sorts of different cuts of meat that people might normally eat, or the fact that a lot of vegetables are very labor intensive, and it looks like people are eating less vegetables than they were, because, you know, generally vegetables are not like calorie dense. You know, they're basically water that are nutrient and fiber delivery systems. And to prepare vegetables, it takes time, it takes knowledge, it takes skill. And so it looks like a lot of people aren't eating as much vegetables. And we may see this shock move through the supply chain because growers are making all sorts of guesses about what's going to sell and what isn't going to sell. So we could start to see, I don't think shortages, but maybe not as much supplies. And something that I've noticed is a lot of the specialty items, I cook a lot of different types of Asian cuisines, and I'm starting to see less of the specialty items that I would see, things like curry leaves, like lemongrass, various types of hot peppers. They appear to be disappearing, and maybe it's just an observation. The vegetables often at higher-end grocery stores don't look as good as they did a couple of months ago, because when you have this supply chain disruption, buyers are going to just try and buy wherever they can get from instead of, you know, prioritizing a certain appearance that they would in the past. And these are minor things, but they are, I think, important indicators of a food system that is undergoing all sorts of shocks. Again, the workers here are also very much on the front line. Like, I understand in Portland, the Kroger-owned Fred Meyer is trying to do away with hazard pay for workers. I've talked to people who go into stores who said for a long time the workers weren't being given PPE, whereas someplace like Whole Foods, the workers had a PPE and had those plexiglass shields pretty quickly. So you can see how companies, Amazon is of course notorious for this, they've been firing workers who've been protesting the hazardous conditions inside the plant, even as Fred Meyer was erecting billboards like, you know, saluting its workers, but now they want to cut their pay. You know, that tells you everything you need to know about the corporate mindset, that they just use them as marketing tools while their profits are increasing massively because of the supply chain disruption. And one last point, April saw the largest rise in consumer prices for food apparently since the CPI began in post-World War II. So in over 70 years, it went up something like 2.6%. which on an annualized basis is over 30%. So there's a distinct possibility that there may be price gouging and profiteering going on. But again, this is nothing new. There was all sorts of profiteering. The last time that Americans really had profound food shortages was World War I, and there was all sorts of profiteering and price gouging going on then as well.
What changes to the food system because of what the pandemic is forcing on producers and distributors, do you fear and or do you see as a positive possibility? In the Michael Pollan piece that I referenced, he says that, you know, this is showing why we need a more decentralized way of producing and distributing our food. And I'm wondering whether you see the situation as pushing us in that direction or just making us too dysregulated as a culture to deal with the problem.
You know, and with the 2008 financial crisis, what we saw is a lot of consolidation. And the prominent Marxist geographer, political economist David Harvey, very early on, he said, we're going to see upward concentration of wealth. And even, you know, as it was happening when in 2008, he was seeing that. And that seemed kind of like incredulous, but that's exactly what happened. So I think rather than see decentralization, in many ways, you're going to see more centralization. Now, having worked in the restaurant industry, you know, you'll often work for these like restaurant groups. And I'm sure there are plenty of them in Portland where there's like one restaurant who's very public, but they have like dozen restaurants. I think one of them is Alder and Sons. Is that right? That they have like a bunch of different restaurants and operations. And, you know, like anything else, it's economy of scale, right? You know, you're going to be more resilient if you have a dozen operations. And certainly they're not a chain, you know, they're high-end restaurant chain. But a lot of the most prominent chefs in America are suffering tremendously. And, you know, like David Chang, who's this very famous Korean-American New York restaurateur, he's like, I don't know if we're going to stay in business. And, you know, he has like multiple Netflix series. He's in the New York Times all the time. And he's like, if we can't stay in business, what does that say for all these mom and pop operations? And so early on, one of the things I was thinking may actually happen, and I don't have any evidence, but I think it's this correct speculation, that we may see the huge fast food companies, the huge chain restaurants, you know, Olive Garden, Chili's, Applebee's, actually start to move into fine dining, where they either start up or they bankroll these restaurant groups that are now going under or on the brink of going under. So we'll see greater consolidation of the food system. Certainly, you know, Amazon stock has just skyrocketed upward. It's since March, it's gone up something like 50%. You know, Jeff Bezos' wealth has increased by tens of billions of dollars. And so, sure, crisis points to a system that is fundamentally broken. But that was the whole thing about the 2008 Great Recession. Everyone was saying, well, this shows neoliberalism has failed. And it's just like, yeah, it's failed, but it's not just going to die on its own. The problem is, I think too many leftists think like a system is just going to collapse on its own. You have to organize. And not organize five of your friends. You have to organize millions of people with the political and social vision and force to change the system, because they're very powerful people, very ruthless people who are happy to kill millions to continue their political domination and accruing their wealth. And this is precisely what we're seeing with the pandemic, where we've heard one billionaire after another. They're like, get back to work, get back to work. People are going to die. Get back to work. Where they're happy to watch us die because their wealth depends on it. So I don't think that it's going to magically decentralize. This is a social battle that has to be organized and fought for in a very brutal manner.
That's a good note to end on. Thank you so much, Arun Gupta, for coming on the Old Bowl today to talk about the food system, its political and economic configuration.
Great being with you. Thank you, Joe.
Say there, did you hear the news? Psycho worked at trimming shoes. Van said he was a peddling man who pushed his fish cart with his hand. Two good men a long time gone. Two good men a long time gone. Psycho and Van said are gone. They left me here to sing this song. Psycho's born across the sea, somewhere over in Italy. Vanzetti born, appearance fine, drank the best Italian wine. Psycho sailed to sea one day, landed up in the Boston Bay. Vanzetti sailed the ocean blue and landed up in Boston too. Two good men's a long time gone. Two good men's a long time gone. Two good men's a long time gone. Left me here to sing this song. Psycho's wife, three children had. Psycho was a family man. Vanzetti was a dreaming man. His book is always in his hands. Psycho earned his bread and butter being the factory's best shoe cutter. Vanzetti spoke both day and night, told the workers how to fight. Two good men a long time gone. Two good men a long time gone. Two good men a long time gone. Left me here to sing this song. I'll tell you if you ask me about this payroll robbery. Two clerks is killed by the shoe factory on the street in South Braintree. Judge there told his friends around that he had cut the radicals down. Anarchist bastard was the name Judge Thayer called these two good men. I'll tell you the prosecutor's name, Katzman, Adams, Williams, Kane. The judge and lawyer strutted down, they done more tricks than circus clowns. Two good men's a long time gone. Two good men's a long time gone. Two good men's a long time gone. Left me here to sing this song. Vanzetti docked in 1908, slept along the dirty street. Told the workers organize and on the electric cherry died.
You just heard a portion of the Woody Guthrie song, Two Good Men. This past Sunday, the 24th, marked the 99th anniversary of the beginning of the Sacco and Vanzetti trial. This has been Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And it is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday at 9 a.m. I want to thank our contributors and guests this morning and remind folks that, of course, you can hear this episode of the Old Mole on KBOO's website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, as well as an archive of past programs. Enjoy your Monday.